be honest with me, because this is so soft and feels so nice, right? You don't wear underwear.
These women are shaving me from head to toe so that I can take part in an amazing event.
I've eaten guys that look like him.
Hey kids, what's happening? Welcome back to My Life as a Foodie. Little Andrew Zimmern for you. Gotta love that dude. He'll eat anything, and he's completely shaven, apparently. I have an interesting show for you guys today. A listener of the show, Bobby Bogner, left a comment on the website last week, said he's been listening for a while, and that he's recently finished production on his new show, Food Tech, on the History Channel, where he goes all over America and Mexico and sees how our food is actually made. And he said there are probably some things on his show that I may not agree with 100%. I sense it's about big agribusiness, and he's probably right. And he wanted to touch base with me before I saw it and went off on his show. And I read this, and, you know, I appreciated that he even listens. But I hope I don't come off as a bully or a loudmouth, although I probably am. I mean, I don't even have a television show, so who am I to talk, really? But when it comes to hosts like Paula Deen or Sandra Lee, those people, I have an issue not only with the food they make, but the fact that Paula Deen keeps some pretty hairy company sometimes. Smithfield Farms, it's not exactly UNICEF, you know? So I question her character more than anything. But a show like this, an investigative show, investigating what's in our food, is actually something I'm interested in. You know, I find the idea of a show like this fascinating. And I thank him for doing it, and I thank him for touching base. So anyway, he's going to be calling in just a few minutes, and we'll be having that chat. His show, Food Tech, debuts this Thursday on the History Channel, which shocked me to find out that they were even doing a food show. For the longest time, people called the History Channel the Hitler Channel because all they showed were World War II documentaries, Nuremberg, Hitler's Third Reich, Pearl Harbor, stuff like that. Obviously, they're really gearing their shows to men now, as they've got a lot like this. And I like the new lineup, so we're going to be talking about that a little later. We'll also be cooking later, too, so get ready for that. We've got some really good stuff in this episode. I was going to feature a beer on the show, but I thought, you know, maybe I'll feature five of them. Last weekend, we had some friends over for dinner, and I thought it might be a good time to break out this vertical collection of Trader Joe's vintage ales that I've been collecting since 2005. So I designed a multi-course menu to go with it, and I made this food, and we had each beer with each course. And it sounds like a lot, but it really wasn't. We had eight people and, you know, five 750-milliliter bottles of beer. So we had a little bit of beer with each course. It wasn't overdoing it, and the meal was kind of paced over a few hours. So I've talked about TJ's vintage ale before on this show. But I got to tell you guys something. The 2009 release that they just released this past fall was maybe the best ever. The beer is made every year by Unibrew, which is the same brewery in Quebec that makes the now infamous Maudite. For those of you who don't listen or who haven't listened to any of the Beer Safari podcasts, Maudite is the beer that Groucho and Chud drank on the Beer Report a couple years ago. And obviously the bottle had gone bad. They said it tasted horrible. Yet they liked other Belgian beers. And anyway, the brewery's amazing. It's all they do is they brew Belgian beers. And they're in Quebec, so, you know, it's kind of this whole French thing. And they stick with that. They do a really good job of brewing Belgian beer. And they're not expensive. They're very moderately priced. And they could easily be expensive because they taste expensive. The one beer they've made that I didn't care for was Terrible, which is kind of a joke because if you read it on the label, it actually says terrible. So I didn't care for that too much, but it wasn't horrible. It just wasn't my favorite. Anyway, these beers that Unibrew makes for Trader Joe's every year are Belgian strong dark ales. They're usually anywhere from 8% to 9% ABV. They're very malty beers with different spices that come from the strain of yeast that they use. They use a different malt bill every time. So the beer tastes slightly different from year to year. And I was getting nervous keeping these beers around for as long as I was, even though I was being really careful about keeping them in a cool, dark place. So to kind of get them out and drink them was a big relief for me, and I didn't have to worry about them anymore. Anyway, the 2007 was everyone's overwhelming favorite. It was spicier than the rest. It was smooth on the tongue, incredibly balanced. I liked the 2009 better, but everybody else said 2007 was the one. It was nice and sweet, had dark fruit flavors, just a really nice beer. The oldest beer, the 2005 release, that was the beer that had me the most nervous because I'd been holding on to it for the longest time. I figured it was either going to be sour or uncarbonated or something had gone wrong. Turns out it was fine. It just lost all the spice that I remember it once having. And I didn't really, it didn't stand up to the rest of them very well. But by the time we were, you know, to that beer, we were kind of beered out anyway. And we were eating chocolate souffle, so it didn't matter. Anyway, if you have a Trader Joe's near you, and they still have any of their vintage ales in stock, mine's out now, I suggest you pick some up. It's $5 for a 750-milliliter bottle of really good, strong, dark Belgian ale. It's not just a great value, but it's a really good beer that you'll be over the moon about. And who knows, you know, maybe you should start your own vertical collection if you haven't started collecting already. It was a good dinner, and it was fun to do something like that.
I'm Bobby Bogner, and I love everything about food. Now I'm on a journey to find out how your favorite meals come from farms, fields, and factories to your plate. So join me for Food Tech.
Premieres Thursday at 9 on History.
So Bobby Bogner hosts a show on the History Channel called Food Tech, where he travels the country to unearth the hidden mysteries inside our food. It debuts this Thursday, and he's joining us on the phone now. Bobby, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Bobby, first off, thanks for taking the time to do this today, but also congratulations on landing this gig.
Isn't it amazing? I just think about how, you know, a year ago I was working in restaurants, and then out of the blue this opportunity comes up, and after 24 years in the restaurant business, I'm now a TV host, and who knows, I might go right back to working in restaurants again, but for now it's a pretty exciting ride.
Yeah.
And you know, the last year and a half that we've been putting them together has been I think a once in a lifetime thing, and you know, a never in a lifetime thing for a lot of people. So I'm thrilled that I got this opportunity.
I'll tell you, not only is it exciting that you've got your, you know, you're a host of a TV show, but on top of that, you're on the same cable channel that features Gunnery Sergeant Arlie Ermey from Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah, yeah. We couldn't get Kubrick to work on Food Tech, but, you know, if he was still around, I'm sure he'd love to join us. And wouldn't that be a pairing?
I love that. Hey, tell us about Food Tech, man. What's the show about?
Sure. Well, Food Tech is a documentary-style show, so no scripts. I go into different farms and factories across the country and show exactly how people are getting the food that they eat on their plate. So every episode, we focus on a different meal. Our debut episode this Thursday is called Cheeseburger and Fries. So we kind of dissect all the ingredients that goes into that classic American meal, from a hamburger roll to beef to lettuce, tomatoes and ketchup, cheese, and then potatoes and French fries. It was an exciting trip. Just for that one episode, I visited, I think, maybe 10 farms and factories. And that was the first episode we shot, so it kind of has a special place in my heart anyhow.
Now, how did you end up hosting this show?
You know, I don't mind telling this story because it is really of the 1950s style, when a pretty girl would sit down at a soda counter and just luck into a director. I was online one day looking at a website called chowhound.com, which is a restaurant review site, and I just saw a post that said History Channel was looking for a TV food host. And I'd never auditioned for anything before. I'm a huge fan of food shows. My wife and I look at those all the time, and I just go, wouldn't that just be a great gig? And so I put in an application or filled out a questionnaire. They called me back for an audition. They called me back for another audition. They called me back for another audition. And a few months later, they offered me the TV show. And so I really had to think about whether or not I wanted to leave my career in restaurants for at least a little while. And my wife and I decided it was a once-in-a-lifetime shot, and I just couldn't pass it up.
That is awesome, man. It is a really hard thing to imagine, to leave everything else behind to do this, in the thought that you may never get that chance again. That's just, it's really cool, man. Really cool. And so I imagine that you've recorded many episodes. Where will you be traveling to? What types of things can we expect to see on your show?
Sure. Well, I can tell you a couple of the episodes this year are the Cheeseburger and Fries that I mentioned. The second episode is called Chinese Takeout. So if you like Peking duck, we show you how ducks are raised and then prepared for that dish. We talk about oyster sauce and how that's made. That was pretty interesting. Soy sauce. Lots of ubiquitous items that we use every day that you just have no idea how they're prepared.
Wow.
So that was really exciting. We went to San Francisco's Chinatown. We went to Pennsylvania to a duck farm. We went to Oregon where Yamasa makes soy sauce.
Awesome.
Later on in the year, I go oyster farming. I went to Florida for shrimping. I went to Mexico and spent a couple days at the Patron Distillery for our Mexican food episode and hung out with the master distiller of Patron.
Nice.
So all over. I think we visited about 40 states, including Hawaii, where I went twice, once for mahi-mahi fishing and once for sugar. And we went to Costa Rica to see how coffee is grown in Terrazu, and Mexico a few times too. So all over the place. But it concentrates mainly on the meals that Americans eat every day.
Oh my God, man. It sounds like they left no stone unturned.
Well, hopefully there are plenty of stones left unturned in case we want a second and a third series.
Now, how many episodes did you shoot?
Ten. And it was about 90 or 100 segments total. I'll tell you, over the time that I was traveling for this, which was about 9 months, I was on about 125 plane flights.
Yeah, that sounds exhausting.
Yes, it was exhausting for sure, but exciting, and especially now that it's finally coming to fruition and we're going to see it on TV this Thursday night and every Thursday night.
Right. Now, how does a show like Food Tech differ from Food Network shows like Unwrapped or Follow That Food?
The biggest difference is that, especially with a show like Unwrapped, which I think is a perfectly fine quality series, that's more of a, we're just going to put a camera on these machines and then tell you how they work. Food Tech puts the personality of the host, which in this case is me, in there, and I'm asking questions as we go through it. You know, I know a lot about food and drink, but I don't know everything by any means. And so I'm learning at every location. And so I think what separates us is the fact that the viewer and the host are learning together rather than the host knowing it and just telling you what's going on. And I think that, after watching the episode, it makes it a whole lot more fun to watch.
See, that is exactly the angle that I think would be the most successful, because the show is like the Food Network show Unwrapped. The guy almost seems like Alex Trebek. You know, the guy knows the answer to every question.
Or knows the question to every answer.
Yeah, right. The other way around.
that's the part that I think that's the reason they got me for this and not, some guy who has done voiceovers for 20 years or has hosted other TV shows before. I mean, when I found out the guys I was up against for this, I was kind of intimidated myself. And then when I ended up getting it, I thought, well, heck, there must have been a reason that they hired Bobby Wagner to host this show.
Yeah, and Bobby, I think they made the right choice. Were there any eye-opening experiences for you? Was there any, in the episodes that you taped, was there any one thing that just kind of blew you away?
I'm not kidding when I say that at almost every stop, I was shocked by something. And not in a bad way, just shocked by the sheer scale of how big things are in food production. And I think that the most overwhelming one was in sugar production in Maui. We were out in the cane fields. I don't know if you know how they prepare sugar cane to be harvested, but they set these huge cane fields on fire to burn off leaves before they come in and chop down the cane. And so to be next to a controlled fire that's the size of 7 or 8 huge city blocks, and then just watch that flame out and have them come in with this lumber equipment and pull in 200,000, 300,000 pounds of cane for processing every day, it's overwhelming. I think that was just the biggest thing I've ever seen in my life, the operations down there in Maui.
That's incredible. And, again, that's one of those things we take for granted every day. When we go to the store and buy table sugar for like $1.25.
Right, and everyone knows that it comes out of a sugar cane somehow. But no one knows that they burn down these fields, they chop down these canes, they mash it up in these huge blenders to extract the sugar, then they dehydrate it, Then they separate the molasses from the sugar. And here's an interesting fact. You know that packet of sugar in the raw that's been so popular the last few years?
Yes.
That's actually a more processed form of sugar than the white table sugar. Because what they do is for all the sugar that comes through the plant, they separate out the molasses from the sugar crystals. And, you know, that's how you have the white sugar and that's how you have the molasses. Well, sugar manufacturers were realizing that they had an excess of molasses that they couldn't sell. So they figured out a way to do it by reintroducing the molasses in a smaller quantity into those white sugar crystals and, you know, recrystallizing it so it has the larger crystals. And so they call it sugar in the raw, and it's been hugely successful for them. But it's actually more processed than white table sugar.
Hey, Bobby, can I tell you something? I smell an Emmy.
Hey, that would be great. That would be great. I'd love it.
Now, you told me earlier that you've been working in the food service industry for 24 years. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, I started out as a dishwasher at a Greek restaurant in Richmond, Virginia. Then I started busing tables. I made pizzas. And then finally, I started waiting tables. And that's kind of where my love is in the restaurant business. I just love front of the house. I love the service aspect of it. You know, I've had a lot of experience doing other things, catering and cooking on a line and bartending and managing. But I would say that the service aspect is my favorite part of the industry. But my last job, I worked at the Getty Center Museum in Los Angeles for 7 years as the director of operations for their food program for a company called Bon Appetit Management. And Bon Appetit, I think, really falls in step with your views of using local and sustainable ingredients and as much farmers market and organic produce as possible.
Awesome.
I left there after 7 years to do the show. My wife is still up there. We met at the museum, and she's the executive chef up there. So, you know, Wednesdays she's at the farmer market, and Fridays she's at the fish market trying to decide what's going to go on the menus for the next week.
I love you guys, man. That is so great. So what style of cuisine are you most comfortable cooking, Bobby? I mean, what would you say is your bread and butter style?
Oh, if we're talking about my cooking, it's got to be breakfast. Anything breakfast I can do better than just about anything else. But I'll tell you, since I got together with a real professional chef, all those little tricks that used to be so cool with my old girlfriends are now, you know, shriveled up. And my wife just puts me to shame. It's been a few years since I've impressed anybody with my cooking.
That's funny, man. 24 years in the food industry is a really long time. How much has the food landscape changed since you started getting involved in it? Like, changed, like, the styles of cooking, the quality of ingredients, the types of ingredients available now?
It's 180 degrees. There's been a huge sea change, and not just with ingredients, but also the taste of Americans. I mean, when I got into it, you know, every restaurant had a spaghetti and meatballs and had a grilled fish dish and had a burger and had a steak. And, you know, to a great extent, you see that a lot across America in small towns where there's not much choice. But especially in the bigger cities like Los Angeles and Washington, D.C. and New York, what we've seen is the flavor profiles change so that now, you know, 25 years ago, I wouldn't have considered putting sushi in my mouth to save my life. You know, and now that's a huge takeout item at convenience stores and in college campuses. You know, that blows me away. So I think that the influences of Asian and Hispanic, especially culture on our food, has definitely changed. In terms of quality of ingredients, I think both in commercially produced and in smaller farm-produced produce, things are better now. I know that there is a... you know, and so this is no joke. I listen to your show all the time, so I know your stance on agribusiness. What I can say is good about agribusiness is that there's, you know, less disease, there's more production, and it costs less. Now, I know that cheap food is not always good food, but that is an improvement. I mean, that's what they were trying to do this whole time. But in terms of family-run farms, you know, there are certainly tools out there now that weren't available before. And so if a farmer wanted to grow a specific kind of corn, or I shouldn't bring up corn because I know that people on your show too, a specific type of carrot, you know, they have tools available to them now that they didn't have 25 years ago. And what that translates to is a greater variety, more seasonal ingredients available to us, and just better food. I mean, my goodness, when I think about the change we've had in the last 24 years, when I was a kid, you know, 15 years old, not knowing what the hell I was doing, to now, I think, holy moly, what's going to happen in 25 years from now? Are we all going to be on local diets? Wouldn't that just be great if we could figure out a way for us to grow food and in a healthy way that also sustains the economic climate as well as the environment? Yeah, I mean, I think we're moving in the right direction in general. Of course, there are lots of things that you and I disagree with agribusiness on. That, you know, there are fewer people going hungry in America than ever before, you know, to the extreme sometimes. But, yeah, in terms of choice and quality, I think it's all better now than it was 25 years ago.
Well, you know, you actually answered a question I was going to bring up, that I wonder at what point, maybe within the next 20 years, we might see more restaurants buying from local farmers and growers rather than big food suppliers like Jack Meir and Sysco. And that maybe we will see within the next 20 years more people eating a local diet, and local being food that's grown by farmers who grow food the right way.
You know, once a chef goes out to a farm and tastes a peach off of a tree, or pulls a carrot out of the ground with a farmer, or meets the guy who's growing great tomatoes for 3 months out of the year, that's what they're going to want to use. Trust me. I mean, you know, chefs really care about what they put out. As a guy who travels all the time, I can tell you that the most depressing thing is when I go to another restaurant that I can tell has the same food company sauces out of a jar. You know, that the chicken teriyaki you get in Des Moines, it's the same chicken teriyaki you're going to get in Cleveland. It's the same chicken teriyaki you're going to get in Miami, because they're all buying a sauce and a frozen chicken breast from some, you know, food distributor. To me, while that's nourishment, it's certainly not nourishing. You know, what I love is creative chefs who use local fresh ingredients to make great food. And I think that anyone who really considers themselves a culinary professional will go out of their way to get good ingredients. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, the vast majority of people have a truck come every Tuesday and bring them prepared foods that they heat up and put on a plate. And they call that a restaurant. You know, and I don't begrudge anybody making a living, but that's not the way I think it should be.
No, and again, I've said this so many times on the show before. The reason why chain restaurants are successful is because of the repetition. Like the Olive Garden. Somebody likes to go to the Olive Garden at home with their family, and they like a particular dish. Well, if they're traveling on the other side of the country, and they happen to go to Olive Garden and order that very same dish, it's going to taste exactly like it tasted at home, as if he was having it with his family, because it's made with the same ingredients, sourced from the very same places. So for that reason, it's successful. Is it same town? It's the same thing every time. There's repetition. It's not what I like, but there is a reason why it's successful.
And that's the same with all businesses. I mean, that's the same reason that a Foot Locker does things exactly the same here in L.A. as they do in Michigan. I mean, that's just the way business works. There's a comfort level when you're traveling, just because you bring this up, there's a comfort level in knowing that you are going to be able to get that same meat ravioli with bolognese at this Olive Garden that you had the other day. But isn't it exciting when you go into a restaurant where you aren't expecting anything and they surprise you with something wonderful?
Yes, absolutely, you're right. And that's, you know, when we get surprised and we fall in love with food all over again.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm still, again, 24 years later, I am still going nuts when I have something great. And that can be something as simple as, you know, we've got this little Asian tapas place in Hollywood called Yat Thai that my wife and I love. It blows me away that, you know, we pay $20 a head for a full meal. Or, I know you bow at the altar of Thomas Keller. You know, when you go to French Laundry, my wife and I went 2 years ago for her birthday. I mean, we still ooh and ah about how amazing that was. So it's not even a fine dining that can open you up to great food. There are plenty of small casual places that do it well, too. It's a matter of, you know, does the person care more about the bottom line, or are they willing to sacrifice a little of the bottom line and a few hours to make a more creative expression of food? You know, I mean, Keller, I think, is near godlike status in terms of his food. but again, you know, all it takes is a little looking to find a place that's willing to work hard and put some creativity on the plate.
Yeah, I love that, Bobby. Now, listen, you've heard the show before, and it's become customary for me to ask people this. If you knew that you were going to die tomorrow and you were going to be having your last meal, what would you want that meal to be?
Well, you know what Keller says, right? I'm sure you know. Keller says roast chicken. Boy, you know what? I would have to say a slice of pizza from Bottoms Up Pizza in my home city of Richmond, Virginia. They used to do a pizza with Chesapeake Bay crab meat, pearl onions, and mozzarella cheese, and I still think about it to this day. But a few years ago, one of my buddies had a big birthday, and I spent $300 to have three pizzas shipped out from Richmond because we loved it that much.
that's addiction, man. You got a problem.
Well, you know, for what it's worth, it's the only reason I ever bother going back to Virginia is for that pizza.
Now, Bobby, you're also a musician, right? You've got this band, the Piper Downs?
Yeah, I sure do.
Now, what kind of music is that?
It's rock music. It's kind of, it would be played on the same radio stations with like a Foo Fighters or a Weezer. But yeah, just in August, we celebrated our 15-year anniversary with the original lineup. I mean, we've been together this whole time. Now we're a bunch of old men, but for years and years, we toured a lot. We've been across the country probably 25 times. We toured in England, we toured in Australia, we toured in Mexico. We've had a couple albums, and we're still playing whenever we can.
Well, I'm going to put a link on the website to Piper Downs on iTunes. You can check them out. What are some of the more popular songs that you have?
Well, we've got one song that's probably the biggest song we've done. It's a song called Louder, and it's ended up on a few TV and movie soundtracks. And I'll tell you, man, if I could make money writing songs, that's the way to go, because, you know, you spend a few days making sure it's a good song, and then someone comes along and says, hey, we'll pay you for this song over and over again. So it's pretty cool. I can't imagine what the big guys are like getting their royalty checks. Every once in a while, I'll get like an $85 royalty check from Singapore or something, and that makes my day.
Are they going to play any of your music on your show?
They are not. I lobbied hard. But Mike Nesmith from the Monkees, his son actually ended up doing all the music.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
The Monkees, huh?
Mike Nesmith's son. It wasn't the Monkees. It was Mike Nesmith's son. but I can't remember his first name. It's something Nesmith.
So the Piper Downs, the name comes from So I Married an Axe Murderer, right?
Exactly right. We have a Piper Down. And, it's funny. The people who recognize that reference love it. And then, you know, of course, half the people have no idea what we're talking about. But I think I love the name since the moment we've named ourselves that.
We have a Piper Down. I repeat, a Piper is down.
I love that too, man. Hey, getting back to food tech for a second, one of my goals on my show has always been to show men how simple it is to cook and to get more guys in the kitchen mixing it up and getting into the craft of constructing a really good meal. The History Channel has a long history of showing World War II documentaries, stuff on Hitler, the Third Reich, Nuremberg, Pearl Harbor, stuff like that. Now it seems they're branching out with a wider variety of shows like Pawn Stars, Monster Quest, Axemen, and your show. What I really like about this is that the History Channel, which has always been geared toward men, is now throwing food in the mix. And I like that they're doing this because, yeah, we're men. We like sports, heavy metal, racing cars, tanks, blowing shit up. But cooking doesn't really fall into that mix very well. Is that perhaps a goal of your show to get men interested in the truth about food?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I don't know the exact numbers, but I know that the viewership of History Channel is up about 85% male. And when you talk about men's television, a lot of people immediately think of something like Spike, you know, where, you know, there's fights or TNA programming or, you know, wrestling, that kind of men's programming. But I would say that for sure History Channel programs to men. And, this is great. And let me tell you, when you see this, this is going to appeal to the guys who like a dirty job style show, because I'll get my hands into anything and I'll jump right in and start cooking or start digging or start plowing. But it'll also appeal to guys who like cooking shows. It'll appeal to guys who like food shows, and it'll appeal to guys who like those How It's Made kind of documentary style or modern marvels, just to get to the nuts and bolts of things. So, I'm counting on bringing up viewership in women. You know, I'm planning on doubling it because I'm so damn good looking, if you've seen my picture. But that said, yeah, this is good. This is a show that is going to be primarily geared to men because that's the viewership of the network.
No, absolutely, and it's a good move. We're going to be talking about this show all year. Now, you've recorded 10 episodes, right?
10 episodes, yep.
Now, is there going to be more this year, or is that the entire season?
That's the entire season. Believe me, it was a long year to get those all made. I mean, the whole thing took about a year and a half, and I was on the road for about 9 months of that year and a half. But if the ratings are good, they're going to bring me back. I know that they can use me for another season in my current contract, and I would love to do it.
Well, we'll do everything we can to keep the interest up, man.
Thanks a lot. Hey, and, you know, seriously, Phil, I'd love to get your feedback afterwards because, again, I know there are going to be some things in this that, you know, that don't jive with your worldview on food. But what I would say is that any education that the American people get about where their food is coming from is good.
No, absolutely.
You know, like it or hate it, this is going to show you exactly what's going on. And, you know, hopefully we can help people see, you know, make some decisions about their food based on knowledge and not just on what's right in front of them.
This is why I think your show has the right attitude. You're going a little deeper under the covers. You're not saying, like, you should go out and buy Reese's peanut butter cups because they're delicious. You're showing what goes into those. That might change people's mind about those things. Or it might just turn their head a little bit. It might make them think twice about eating something. It might be something that might not be good for them or may be good for them that they had not thought of eating before.
Well, that's the other part, is that I think it's real tempting to demonize huge food companies for what they're putting out. But let me tell you, there are going to be a few items that you wouldn't expect to be as wholesome as they are. And when you see them, you're going to be surprised. So, yeah, I think it's going to go both ways.
Okay, so this week you're doing cheeseburgers and fries. Next week it's all about Chinese food. Is there a show coming on later in the season that you're most excited about everybody seeing?
The show I'm most excited about for the rest of the season is the Mexican show. Not only does it have, like, the coolest locales, because I go to Mexico a couple of times, and I go to Hawaii to fish for mahi-mahi, for fish tacos, but also, I mean, that's food that I love to eat. And so it was really exciting to see how that gets put together. But it's also the prettiest, and I'm also on a boat instead of in a factory, and I'm also in the woods instead of in a factory for a lot of it. So it's a great one, and I think that might even be the third episode.
Okay, well, that could be coming up within the month, then, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, listen, Bobby, I want to thank you, man, for taking the time to talk with us. I know you've got a lot going on this week.
Yeah, my baby boy, my first son, was just born 3 days ago. And actually, right now, I'm calling you from Cedar Sinai. I'm doing this interview from Cedar Sinai because my boy's getting some blood tests. But, yeah, I said to my dad the other day, isn't it interesting that, you know, you have a show coming on a national network, and that's still the second best thing that happens in your week? Because I've got my new son now.
Well, I'll tell you, you're already starting this year off right, Bobby. Congratulations.
Well, thanks, Phil. And call me back sometime in the, you know, after you've seen a couple episodes, and we'll talk more.
Absolutely. He's Bobby Bogner. His show Food Tech debuts this Thursday on the History Channel. Check your local listings, get a season pass on TiVo, and also don't forget to check out his band, The Piper Downs, on iTunes. We'll put a link on the website. You guys can check it out. Thanks, Bobby.
Thanks a lot, though. I really appreciate it.
By now, people across the country and perhaps the world have seen these images, including 19-year-old Alicia McMullen.
It's really petty. I wish I would have never done it. I wish I could go back to that day and take it back and say, I've never done that.
That's her in the video taken inside a Kansas City McDonald's just a couple of days after Christmas.
And I should have just left, really, but all of it built up.
The video shows McMullen throwing mop water over the counter, pushing over a cookie jar, then the cash registers, all before leaving and becoming a wanted suspect for property damage. Today, McMullen says the video fails to tell the whole story.
She really pushed me there. She pushed me there.
McMullen says it all started when she tried to return a snack wrap. She says it was cold and that the female employee would only give her a cheeseburger.
No, ma'am, I didn't ask for that, and that ain't what I paid for. But I didn't, and just how I'm coming to you and talking to you, how I'm telling you, this is exactly how I came to her.
McMullen says words were exchanged and things escalated from there.
I didn't just snap out on the lady. The lady flipped me off first, cussed me out, did all that.
And McMullen claims when employees in the back joined in, it set her off and started the tirade that played out in front of customers and their kids.
I will apologize to the parents that were there with their kids. I'm so sorry y'all had to see me act like that because that was very disrespectful. I'm sorry your kids had to see that, and I do apologize for all of that.
That was awesome. When are we going to start pointing out that it's asked, not axed, and it's first, not first? I mean, this lazy speech is killing me. Improve your language, and people might start treating you and thinking of you the way you feel you should be. I'm not taking sides on this. I'm just saying language is important. Stop sounding like a dumbass. Like it's cool not to give a shit about how you talk. And stop eating McDonald's. Okay, so here's some homework for you guys. A way for you to be interactive with the show and a way for you to get your name mentioned on a future episode. I want you guys to watch Bobby's show Food Tech this Thursday on the History Channel. And at the very least, watch the first episode. Then think of a question to ask him regarding his show. Maybe, you know, what'd you think of the egg roll you had? Or what was it like to drink the water when you went to Mexico? Something. Anything related to one of the first three episodes. I'd like to have him back on, and maybe in a month or so. And I'd like to read some of your questions and have him answer them. Maybe they're just general questions about, you know, doing the show. Maybe something I didn't ask him. Maybe I dropped the ball a little bit. I'm sure I didn't ask every possible question. So put your thinking caps on. And don't bail on me here, all right? I need your help. Email your questions to phil@mylifeasafoodie.com. I'll get about four or five of them, maybe more. Depends on how interactive you guys want to be. And then I'll read them on the air and I'll ask him when we have him back on. I caught that he didn't agree with my views on commercial agriculture. ConAgra stuff, corn-fed, mass-produced beef. I'm not sure exactly what. Maybe the Monsanto thing, too. I'm not sure. He said something about corn. I'll ask him about it next time. It's totally fine for anybody to bring that up here. I just want you guys to know that. I wear my opinions on my sleeve here because this is the forum I have to do that. And it's your forum to do it too, all right? This is your show as well. Don't think that you have to agree with me, you know, on what I have to say on commercial farming or agriculture. Or for that matter, you know, if you want to buy your vegetables from Mexico or Peru or whatever, I don't care. If you don't feel like supporting American farmers, that's your prerogative. I never want you to feel like I'm going to not like you because of that. That's nuts. You know, we're all foodies. We're all friends here. And my politics never have to be your politics. However, if I do find out any of you have switched to Bud Miller or Coors, I'll disown you. So the Atlantic had a piece last week caught my eye. How safe is genetically modified corn? And without reading, you can pretty much guess that one. Not very. French investigators published a reinterpretation of some feeding studies in small samples of rats. The studies were done originally by Monsanto to test three varieties of the company's genetically modified corn. These investigators obtained the data from the feeding trials as a result of the court case in Europe, which Monsanto lost. They analyzed the data using their own statistical methods. Marion Nessel, who wrote this piece, found the paper extremely difficult to read, in part because it's written in really deep language, and also in part because it presents the data in especially complicated tables and figures, she said. Probably read like a technical manual for an atom splitter or something, you know? Anyway, here's their conclusion, and this is just a hot mess. Our data strongly suggests that these GM maize varieties induce a state of toxicity, meaning they're bad for you. This can be due to the new pesticides, herbicide or insecticide, present specifically in each type of GM maize. Although unintended metabolic effects due to the mutagenic properties of the GM transformation process cannot be excluded. Good Lord, dude. What did that even mean? Scientists, man. You gotta wonder, what do these people do for fun? Do they get laid? I don't know, man. It's language like that. It's just kind of nuts. It's the opposite of the McDonald's thing. All three GM maize varieties contain a distinctly different pesticide residue associated with a particular GM event. These substances have never before been an integral part of the human or animal diet, and therefore their health consequences for those who consume them, especially over long time periods, are currently unknown. Furthermore, any side effect linked to the GM event will be unique in each case, as the site of transgene insertion and the spectrum of genome-wide mutations will differ between the three... Forget it. And of course, Monsanto responds. What is it? Let's see here. They said, much shorter rebuttal. Bullshit. Now, they had a well-thought-out, lengthy response, of course, and it was equally as boring to read. Laboratory findings primarily related to kidney and liver function reflect a large proportion of tests applicable to these organ systems. All right. The authors apply a variety of non-standard statistical approaches Each unique statistical approach and each comparison performed increases the number of statistically significant findings. Okay, so the more they tested, the more they'd find. The authors undertake a complex principal component analysis to demonstrate that kidney and liver function tests vary between male and female rodents. Oh, you know what? I could go on, but really, why would I? Let's just say that any time you put the words genetically modified anything in front of my food, I'm going to decline serving it on my table. Monsanto can suck it, all right? I don't agree with it, and they'll go back and forth on this stuff. They'll constantly try to defend themselves, but they're full of shit. I watched Food Inc. again recently because that whole soybean thing was on my head for some reason. I don't know why. And I still can't believe how much they resemble the mob. How they get away with treating farmers the way they do, and the government lets them because they've got a lot of money. It literally, people think the mafia no longer exists. No, it exists. It's in big business now. That is exactly how the mob used to be run in the good old days. And it's exactly what's happening now. So keep eating it. You guys remember this story? A couple weeks ago, a federal grand jury indicted Umar Farouk Abolabadindong, that Nigerian guy who allegedly tried to set off a bomb hidden in his underpants on Northwest Airlines flight to Detroit. Do you remember this? The bomb didn't go off and blow off his junk or the plane, but it suddenly created this demand for pat-down searches, body scans, finger-up-your-ass examinations for airline passengers who are headed from other countries into the U.S. Now, why am I bringing this up? What does it have to do with food? Well, this article appeared in the New York Times, and about killed me. These searches now are likely to catch chefs smuggling meat from Europe. Chefs like Ray Knight, who once flew from Italy to Miami with a pork shoulder and fennel pollen salami, vacuum sealed and hidden inside of a stainless steel water bottle. Another time, he says he hid a 4-pound goose liver torchon from France inside the belly of a salmon. I had no idea they did this stuff. Smuggling is something you do with drugs or kids, said Chris Constantino. Our goal is to improve the food system. Because custom officials once caught him with sausages made from donkey parts, hidden inside shoes, packed in his luggage, Mr. Constantino's bags were already subject to extra attention. He once got around that by duct taping to the inside of his blue jeans seeds for a special variety of chicory he found at a pet food store in Bologna, Italy. Scanners able to see through clothing now being installed in many foreign airports should put an end to that. This is so stupid, it's killing me. First of all, it's just food. You know, what's the big deal? We're not bringing in bombs. Food, not bombs. Secondly, and this is the most important thing, what the hell is Chris Constantino doing with sausages made from donkey parts? You're eating donkeys now? That's a little weird, man. I don't even know that Andrew Zimmern would eat a donkey. Donkey! It's kind of messed up. I mean, is that necessary? What happened to your love of, like, all things pig, man? Let's get back to that. I don't know. That's a little troubling. I look at a donkey and I just think, that's not food. It's like horse meat. Worse. So I guess of all things, the last thing I thought I'd read about Constantino is that he smuggled donkey sausage in his underpants. It's a bizarre world, man. It really is. It just gets weirder. But you know, people have been eating this stuff for years. So, you know, I'm obviously the weird one. Hey, Tony Bourdain has returned for a 6th season of No Reservations. You can catch him Mondays at 7 on the Travel Channel. You already know the drill. Season lasts all year, but it's cut up. It's chopped up because it takes a long time for them to put these shows together. And you heard Bobby talk about that, man. Man, that's rough. A year and a half to put together 10 shows? There's a lot of work goes into these things, so don't take them for granted. The destinations on these shows kind of trickle in. So far, he's been to Panama, Istanbul, next week, Brittany, France, then Prague, Hudson Valley, New York, and then more to follow after that. In case you've missed the Panama and Istanbul shows, here are a couple clips to wet your whistle.
Meat in hand. That doesn't sound quite right, does it? Okay, meat in the bag.
It's a pretty neat, easy to eat. You know, not the big, messy, leaky thing. A little torpedo of joy.
Pick a meat, lamb please, dig a pit, put in fire, add dead animal. Seal and allow to cook. You'd think even Sandra Lee could do this, if the animal came in a can. The following scene is an accurate depiction of what pretty much just happened at the last minute. Really. One minute, me and the crew sitting in the offices of the Director of National Security, little courtesy call, cup of coffee, and then suddenly, this. Holy that's a lot of mother cocaine.
6 tons right there.
As Director of National Security, Gustavo is sending a message. He's also invited me to do something I'd never thought I'd find myself doing in a million years. Burn 6 freaking tons of pure, uncut cocaine.
There will be no Lindsay Lohan jokes.
6 tons!
6 tons. Wholesale value.
This is over 300 to 600 million.
So these are all kilo blocks?
Yes, kilo blocks. 1 kilo, one life. Oof. Well, you can imagine how many lives in here.
15 years ago, this would have been what I asked Santa Claus to bring me for Christmas. It looks like Keith Richards' bedspread back in the 70s, along with world peace and a magical pony that crapped gold Krugerrands.
No reservations, 7 p.m. every Monday on the Travel Channel. Set your DVRs. They replay the hell out of that show, too, so you can always catch them up. Anytime during the week, you can catch up on a show. All right, so check this out. In our office at Christmas, we were doing a potluck. I know a lot of people think potlucks are lame, but in our office where I work, we've got some home cooks, man. Some really good cooks. I have never had a bad potluck while I've been working for this company. We decided that the potluck this year would be spoon food, meaning the only you had to bring stuff that could only be eaten with a spoon. So everybody's making soups and stews, stuff like that. Everything was rocking. Our director of sales made Julia Child's beef bourguignon. That should give you an idea of what kind of food we had at this thing. So I decided to make this savory custard with leeks, gorgonzola, and my home-cured bacon. I got a really good response from that, so I decided to make it again last weekend, and it was a hit at the dinner party, too. So now I'm going to make it with you guys so you can enjoy it. This is really fun. It's a really good dish. It's very simple, and if you leave out the bacon, it turns into a vegetarian dish that you can make the next time a pain-in-the-ass vegetarian comes to your house for dinner and, you know, demands an option. So let's go into the kitchen. We're going to make this leek and gorgonzola savory custard. Okay, here's what you're going to need. So you can start making a shopping list now. 1 tablespoon extra virgin olive oil. 6 ounces of country bacon diced into small squares. 12 ounces of leeks split lengthwise, washed thoroughly, and sliced crosswise. 5 large egg yolks, 1 cup of heavy cream, 1 cup of half and half, 8 ounces of gorgonzola cheese, chopped up, 1 tablespoon of minced fresh tarragon, or if you have dried, if you can't get it fresh, you can use dried, 3 tablespoons of minced Italian parsley, salt, and freshly ground black pepper. All right, so first thing we want to do, make sure the oven is preheated to 325. Now, in a small or medium saucepan, heat the oil over medium heat and render the bacon until crispy. While that's happening, we're going to slice our leeks. Now, I like these in 1/2-inch strips, so just chop those up. And later you can soak them in water to rinse any dirt that might be hiding out. Now, once that's done, we're going to remove our bacon from the oil. Okay. Leave about 1 teaspoon of the bacon drippings in the pan here, okay? Now, take our leeks, get our leeks over here, saute these now for 7 to 10 minutes until soft. Okay, we got those going. Now, in a medium bowl, we're going to whisk the egg yolks until frothy. Whisk them until they're frothy. All right, now add in the cream and the half and half. Now mix that in. Okay, now we're going to add the leeks and the gorgonzola and the tarragon, the parsley, the salt, and the pepper. Okay, now, place 6 standard-sized custard or flan dishes in a baking pan. Rub the insides of the dishes with butter or spray them with Pam or some kind of nonstick spray, okay? Divide the custard mixture among the dishes. Warm water now. We want warm water in the pan to come halfway up the sides of the dishes. All right, we'll go halfway up. You don't want to cheat this. It's basically what happens here is that the custards are gonna kind of simmer, and you don't want them to take on any color, but they're gonna have to simmer in a water bath, so they're almost like they're poaching. And this is how you make custard. Now cover the pan with foil. You don't want the tops to take on any color. And then put it in the oven. And bake this now for 35 to 40 minutes or until the center of each custard kind of jiggles a little bit. You can test it with a toothpick. Then when they're done, you remove them from the oven. Lift the dishes from the hot water. Allow them to cool for about 5 minutes. And then you can serve them. You don't want to eat this right out of the oven. All right, unless you never want to taste anything with your tongue ever again. This stuff is super, super hot. So let it cool down a little bit. You can even have this at room temperature if you want it. Just let them cool down. And that is leek, gorgonzola, and bacon custard. Go get them. Anyway, listen, this has been fun, but I gotta go. Thanks again for tuning in. Don't forget to check out Bobby on his new show, Food Tech. Premieres this Thursday on the History Channel. Thanks again to Bobby for calling in. Also, don't forget to check out his band, The Piper Downs, on iTunes. Check the website, mylifeasafoodie.com. I'll have links for everything. Music in this episode from The Veer Union. If you like the song, you can download it from the iTunes store, 99 cents. Check out our website for a direct link. You can own the full quality version. Thanks to CNN for the audio. Thanks to you for listening. Until next time, my name is Phil. This has been My Life as a Foodie.